So last week what we discussed was primarily the concept of prusbel, and we used that in order to clarify a couple of points, one of which was that we had seen that the whole idea of prusbel, which again to remind us, is on a Torah level, if somebody makes a loan during the sabbatical year, that loan gets canceled at the end of the year. So what we had seen was that Hillel came and instituted something called the prusbel, that loans don't get canceled. So as far as our conclusion, again based on the sources that we had seen, was that prusbel is understood to have been during the time that Shemitah was Midrabanan. If Shemitah is Midrabanan, Shemitah is only on a rabbinic level, that means the money that you lent is really yours. That means that loan should not have been canceled. So in a sense, what Hillel is doing is not breaking the law. What he's doing really in a sense is that he's defending the law. And as I said, people often get a little bit confused on that point. Just one more word about this. It would seem to be that the rationale of this halacha is as follows. There are some people who during the sabbatical year have things growing, their land or their property is made ownerless, all the other people come and take whatever they want. So it would seem to be that this idea that loans get canceled is a way to divide. So let's put it this way. Who's going to need money during the sabbatical year? The farmer's going to need money. Why? Because they don't have any income. So therefore, this would seem to be a halacha that will help those who don't have money to get paid for the free produce that people have been taking. So in a sense, it's really fixing a situation. But what happens when Shemitah is Midrabanan? That means the money really belongs to the person who lent the money. They should get it back. But again, I'm going to stress that all that Hillel seems to have done is to have fit this into a pre-existing category, because we saw that only personal loans get canceled, but loans which were from the Beit Din or other institutionalized loans were not canceled, and that again seems to be what Hillel did. Okay, moving on from that, and I'm going to come back to some of this soon, but as I said, I wanted to go more into the Heter Mechira. I think there are very few topics in Judaism, certainly not in the last 100 years or so, which have been as contentious as the Heter Mechira. And if any of us actually want to do research and study about it, the first thing I'd have to warn you is, who are you reading? Who's presenting the information? Because whoever's presenting the information may present things which are a little bit different. Now, when I started, whenever this was, before Pesach even, and we discussed the idea of legal fiction. So one of the legal fictions that came up right away was the idea of selling chametz. So when we looked at it in depth, we came to the realization that this is not a legal fiction. May depend which way you understand it, but it's not a fiction. So there are others who would see that selling the land during Shemitah is also a legal fiction. Hold it a second. How do you go and sell the land, and how does this work? And does it work? So as I said, this has been incredibly contested. So let's go back a little bit, and I'm going to start in modern times. Although before we finish, I'm going to go back to ancient times, and I think we're going to see some things which are interesting. So when did Jews start coming back? And that's an unfair question. When did Jews start coming back and start being farmers again? Because there were plenty of Jews who came here who were not necessarily farmers, which really then creates a great question. So how exactly did they live? But the modern, what we can call, for lack of a better term, Aliyah movement, which is the one which really started to bring people back for the purpose of working, I'm going to pick what sometimes could be called the first Aliyah, even though, let's realize, there were plenty of Jews who moved here before the first Aliyah. So the first, I'm going to use right now the year 1882 for a very simple reason, that it was a Shemitah year. So that itself became significant. There were not all that many Jewish communities that were farming communities. Petach Tikva was one. Now, even Petach Tikva was begun by the Solomon family, who were from the family of the students of the Gra, who had came over around 1812, 1813. They already lived in Israel. So again, just pointing out, long before they speak about the first Aliyah, which is the 1880s, there were groups of people that came over, 1813, 14, 15, and so on, who lived in Yerushalayim, the old city, then spread out, Nachlat Shiva, and other places. But the first time that groups of farmers came for the purpose of farming, so there's Maskeret Batya, and there is Petach Tikva, and a couple of other places, but there weren't all that many, what we'll call them, Yishuvim, which were for farming. 1882, we have a problem, and 1882, the problem was solved by virtue of having a Heter Mechira. Those of you who are not clear about this, and think that the Heter Mechira is exclusively something connected to Rav Kook did not arrive in Israel till years afterwards, 20 years afterwards, more than 20 years after this, is the first time Rav Kook is here. So he's not even here at this point. Rav Kook is in Europe at this point, having nothing to do with this Heter Mechira. And here's another thing, which I, in the last couple of days, just read a whole bunch of articles, descriptions, discussions about the Heter Mechira, and almost none of them mention, and certainly not in depth, this is totally biased reporting, they only talked about the Ashkenazim, and they don't bother talking about the Sfaradim. Okay, so in 1882, the one who gave the Heter Mechira was the Rishon Lezion, was the Sfaradi chief rabbi, Harav Elyashar. He gave it. It was also supported by other Rabbanim, and important to say, they based themselves on a certain Rav Revio, if that's how you pronounce his name, who wrote a book called Sur Hamor, which goes back hundreds of years. He was a Rav in Hebron, and there was somebody who had some vineyard. And the fellow said that if I don't work the vineyard or whatever, it's going to die, I need to work it. So the solution then was to sell it. I'm saying this is 300 years ago. The Heter Mechira is at least 300 years old. And then was, as I said, the Sephardic rabbi said, yeah, this is what we've been doing. We sell it to non-Jews, we sell it to the Muslims, and that's how we get through Shemitah. So I'm just saying is that it's only when the Ashkenazim got here when they started to make trouble. So just realize that as well. The farmers who lived in Petach Tikva, they went to Rabbanim, and at the end, the Ashkenazic Rabbanim didn't know what to do, and they pushed it over to the Sfaradim, who will posek, sell it, and everything is okay. In 1889, so now we've moved over to the next Shemitah, again, the second one in modern times, there was a rabbi named Rav Naftali Hertz. He was the Rav of Yafo and all surrounding Yishuvim. And the farmers came to him asking him what to do. He, in turn, sent the question back to the leading rabbis in Europe. Now, just in case you're going to ask yourself, but what do the rabbis in Europe have to do with anything? So the rabbis in Europe were actually the ones who encouraged the farmers to come here in the first place. And this is something which is beneath the surface of the whole Heter Mechira discussion. It's always about money. It's like they said by Watergate, follow the money. It's always about money. And the old yeshuv was subsisting based upon donations from Europe. Not 1 year in seven, 7 years in seven. The fact that new farmers came and they're going to start living on their own and supporting themselves is a whole new idea. And the people that are actually working, who, by the way, very religious people. So there is an important background to all this, including Rav Shmuel Mahlover, who is one of the leaders of the Zionist movement, or what's called the I don't know what's called Ohavei Tzion at the time. He actually raised the money to get the farmer's land from Rothschild, who now the question becomes, are they going to hit up Rothschild for more money on the seventh year? Or are they going to be able to somehow live on their own the seventh year? So the rabbis, they don't go, and that's why they go back to the rabbis in Europe, because they're the ones who had sent them in the first place. And so if Naftali Hertz, he's the Rav of Yafo, he ends up, as I said, turning to the rabbis in Europe who approve of the Heter Mechira. The first rabbi who was asked was actually the rabbi in France, who was at we can call him more or less Rothschild's rabbi, who said, this is out of my pay grade. And he went, eventually it went to Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, who who, if you don't know the name, was the most important posek in Europe at the time. He ended up supporting it, and one of the things which is claimed, although again, I always have to be careful with the claims, is that he found that book from the rabbi in Hebron from hundreds of years before, and he said, oh, look, this is what the minhag is, this is what they do in Israel, this is how they deal with Shemitah, and he supported it. Other people who supported it were other major poskim, Rav Yeshua Mikutna, Rav Yosef Engel, and Rav Shmuel Molivar. So what you had was a whole bunch of rabbis supporting it. You also, well, had a couple of things. One is that they felt a little uncomfortable giving the psak from Europe, so they actually gave a condition, go to the rabbis in Yerushalayim and make sure that they approve. Which, of course, that's where the problem then begins, because the rabbis in Yerushalayim will not approve. So you, now you're going to get caught into your politics over here. At the end of the day, they went to the Sephardic rabbis, who once again approved it, as they did by the previous Shemitah, and it was approved. And I'm saying, but that's the first one that Rav Hertz from Yafo got the European rabbis involved. Yes? No. But at the same time, there were major rabbis in Europe who were absolutely against this, including, and most predominantly, the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva. And I'm going to mention parenthetically that Rav Kook learned in the Volozhin, and he was a student of the Netziv. And there's a long tshuva from the Netziv. And when you read the tshuva, and this you will most likely disagree with me because you've never read any of the other tshuvot, the Netziv, maybe you read his commentary on the Chumash, the tshuva on Shemitah is very strident. It's a very, very, very cynical tone. It's a very strong tshuva. And I didn't love the halachic arguments in it, so I'm sorry for saying that, because that doesn't sound like a very nice thing to say. A number of years ago, a Jew who was it's just an unbelievable tragedy on many, many levels, but he and his wife were murdered, Eitam Henkin, wrote an article about this, and he discovered, lo and behold, he discovered the writings of the Netziv's son, Rabbi Chaim Berlin, who would eventually come to Yerushalayim. By the way, he later becomes one of the rabbis in Yerushalayim who's against it. And Rabbi Chaim Berlin says, oh, that tshuva my father did not write. He said, there's a long, long tshuva, because most of it is not my father. And a matter of fact, there was another essay that was printed by somebody else with his name at the same time, who had sent it to his father to look at, and whoever published his father's writings found all these things on Shemitah and just threw it all together. Which means a third of the tshuva is his, and two-thirds of it is just from somebody else, and that includes the best line of the tshuva, which is always quoted by the Netziv. I guarantee you that if you Google this, you look this up, you'll find everyone saying the Netziv wrote this. It's not the Netziv's. He just didn't write this. He looked at it. I don't know if he agreed or disagreed, but I will give you the best line in a moment. It says as follows. The Imkain Efshar... You don't have it. I have all kinds of things you don't have today. The Imkain Efshar Limkor Yishmael Hamchiro V'Tarvei Shviat Shel Avodot Kochavim. I can sell it to the non-Jew. V'Akati Yishlomar, I'm skipping a little bit. U'Mikol Mokom Yishlomar D'Mishum Hefsid Nam Yesh Lakel B'Zad Kal V'Sholom U'Ve'emet Barach Mehaze'ev U'Pagabo Ari. Let me explain what he just now said. The key phrase, though, was you ran away from the ze'ev, from the wolf, but you bumped into the lion. That's the key line that everyone quotes the Netziv. It's not his line. But this is what it means. If Shemitah today is Rabbanan, and you sell the land to avoid Shemitah, which is Rabbanan, he says, that's wonderful, except you just now broke a Torah law of selling land in Israel to non-Jews in order to keep a rabbinic law. So he's saying that the Heter Mechira has no place to start. You're breaking Torah law. Now, if you can ask me what the various objections to the Heter Mechira are, let's first understand what it is. Heter Mechira is, I'm going to take the land of Israel, sell it to a non-Jew, so at this point, the land isn't owned by a Jew, so it lost its kedushah. I want to pause there for a second, because even that is dependent upon a machloket. There are those who say that selling the lands won't work. On the other hand, if Shemitah is midrabanan, so when the Rabbanan said that there is Shemitah, did the Rabbanan say there is Shemitah when it's owned by a non-Jew? I mean, yes, are you with me on this? The Rabbanan don't really have control over non-Jews to tell them what to do. So therefore, why should the Shemitah work midrabanan? That's the basic logic of the Hetzer Mechira. I'll say it again. Shemitah is the Rabbanan. Sell it to a non-Jew. Dinei Rabbanan doesn't apply by non-Jews, so therefore you're free. Again, there are those who claim that selling the land doesn't work in terms of getting away the Kedushah. The Kedushah didn't go anywhere. Now, that may be true of Shemitah's Midyoraita. Shemitah's Drabanan, why would it not go away? There is a tshuva of the Beit HaLevi, who, by the way, the same time the Netziv was the Rosh Hashiva in Velazh, and the Beit HaLevi was his co-Rosh Hashiva, and he wanted to claim that there are different types of Drabanan, and the sale would not work for some other technical reason. If you want to know why the Chazon Ish thought it didn't work, because he says, now let us sell the land. Now let us sell the land, then you're shliach l'dvar aveira. If you're shliach l'dvar aveira, so then the sale didn't work. By the way, that was very good, except that most people would agree with every word the Chazon Ish said. First of all, if you think that it's not an aveira, you think you're allowed to do it, so why is it shliach l'dvar aveira? Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked along these lines, and he obviously disagreed with the Chazon Ish. He says, if your Rav told you that you're allowed to sell the land, are you allowed to sell it? So basically, again, I'm really oversimplifying now, but Rav Moshe said yes. There are rabbis who say it's okay, so that's okay. The question that was actually posed to Rav Moshe was that free vegetables were being given out to certain schools, but they were from the Hetzer Mechira. So the principal of the school asked, am I allowed to feed these kids these vegetables? Or am I feeding them something which is not kosher? So Rav Moshe said, there's no lifnei either. He goes, it's not placing a stumbling block. Their rabbis say that it's okay. These children, their parents think it's okay, so it's okay. You disagree, so you don't need it. You're allowed to give somebody this food. It's fine. So what happened to Shliach HaDvar Aveira? Rav Moshe did not believe that that was real. And by the way, most people disagreed with the Chazon Ish on this, and the problem is that the Chazon Ish was adopting a minority opinion which is really not accepted. I'm going to give you an example. And what I'm saying now is really from the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim years ago, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, wrote an essay arguing, or tshuva, arguing with the Chazon Ish. If a man says to a woman, Harei am akudeshali, and gives her money, so they're married, right? Okay. What if he's a Kohen and she's divorced? And he gives the money, are they married? Yeah. He's not allowed to marry her, but they're married. So what if he says to a shaliach, here's money, or ring, go give her the ring and say, Harei am akudeshet lo. I know it's not so romantic. Harei am akudeshet lo, bitabat zo kedat Moshe Yisrael. Are they married? Ein shliach l'dvar aveira. So when you say ein shliach l'dvar aveira, it has to do with punishment. So who gets the punishment for marrying somebody that you shouldn't marry? Did the shliach get the punishment, or does the person get the punishment? But does the marriage take place? The Chazon Ish says the marriage doesn't take place. That's an absolute minority opinion, which I'm willing to say we don't really accept. The accepting thing is that, no, ein shliach l'dvar aveira is a question of punishment, not a question of effectiveness of the action. So when the Chazon Ish claims that you weren't allowed to sell the land, and you sold the land, and the Rabbanut was the shliach, ein shliach l'dvar aveira, so it never happened, the Chazon Ish is really going off on a limb by claiming this, and I'll say it again, most people did not accept the Chazon Ish, and I said this is a much earlier argument between the Ksot and the Netivot. It's an argument, does something work that you weren't allowed to do by shlichut? And the answer is that the general accepted opinion is it does work, and therefore the Chazon Ish's major argument falls apart. So now going back, so what exactly is the problem? So the Netziv then, it's man. He wanted to say ein shliach l'dvar aveira means it didn't work. It just doesn't work. And I'm saying that's just not really the accepted halacha. So now we're going to go backwards again. Ein shliach l'dvar aveira? It's a known gemara.
Okay. So can you give an example
where it falls? Ein shliach l'dvar aveira, a more classic case would be I ask you to kill somebody for me. So who's guilty of killing, me or you? But who's guilty of killing? You're guilty of killing, right? Because normally you say shliach shel adam kimoto. If you're a shliach, you like the person himself. So God told you not to kill, and I told you to kill. So who should you be listening to? You should be listening to God. So ein shlich devar avira. So therefore, the normal rules of shlichut, that is, if normally shlichut is that you are an extension of my hand. It's as if I have a long hand now. That's really the language of the poskim. So it's as if I have a longer hand. I couldn't reach there, so you reach there. So it's as if my hand now was extended. But that's by doing something good. By doing something bad, ein shlich devar avira. But that normally means a question of punishment. You did something bad, you get punished. Now over here, you're allowed to marry that person. You're not a kohen. He's a kohen. So now, how exactly does that work? Now, who gets the punishment? Does he get a punishment for it? No. You are not allowed to marry. So, as I said, there are going to be different cases, different applications, which is an interesting topic, but the Chazon Eish's claim over here was really an overstatement. But going back to this supposed nitziv, actually, the person who wrote this was of Yeshua Heschel Margoliot, who was the Rav of Vishanava, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, which was a small town near Volozhin, and he's the one who wrote this whole kuntris, which I was able to, it's called Kol HaTorah Nishma Ba'artzeinu. I found it on Hebrew Books yesterday, I downloaded it. Once again, any of the sources that I did not bring to class and you want to see, I'll be happy to send them to you. But he there wrote this whole big thing, published in his own name, and some publisher thought that Nitziv wrote it and threw it in over there, and he has this line as well. Now that's an interesting claim. The claim over here is that you're breaking a Torah law in order to get away from a rabbinic law. By the way, that doesn't tell you how the Mechira doesn't work. According to the Chazon Ish, it doesn't work. That just tells you it's the wrong thing to do. Okay, so going back a step, we had 1882, the major first, well, that's not major, because it's a very small group of people. They eventually get to the Sephardic rabbis, they allow it. 1889, Rabbi Naftali Hertz gets to all of these rabbis. They say, follow whatever the rabbis of Yerushalayim say. The rabbis of Yerushalayim don't agree, which is where we're stuck over here. So now you have machloket areas. But just to make it good, as I say, there are a whole bunch of other rabbis get involved, including the Nitziv and the Beit HaLevi and the Aruch HaShulchan, which I'm not sure was known at the point. I think it was only published much later. Somebody known as Rav David Karlina, who was also a very significant posek. So, and if you're wondering where the whole fight begins, so you have the rabbi saying, it's okay, het mechira, and it's been long the Sephardic tradition. You then have the Kenazic rabbis in Yerushalayim saying, absolutely not. And then you have some rabbis in Europe coming, and this by then, by 1889, becomes this major, major, major argument. I will point out, though, and this is very important, that all the farmers involved at this point are religious farmers. You read some of the things. The religious farmers kept Shemitah. The not-so-religious farmers used the Het Mechira. Excuse me. The non-religious farmers didn't ask any rabbis anything about what to do, and they didn't care. This was all religious farmers, and if you would look at them, by the way, you would think that pictures of them, you would think that all of them were Hasidim in the way that they dressed. Exactly. Exactly. I'm saying that it's totally circular and unfair reasoning to say, oh, the religious ones kept Shemitah. By the way, some of the religious ones who kept Shemitah properly also died. Okay? They died. You know why they died? Because they didn't have food. And I'm not overstating this. Yes, yes. So, which means you're dealing with a time period that this was extremely dangerous. And telling people, no, you should keep Shemitah and you should have more faith in God, and those are the religious people, they sometimes are also the dead people. And again, I'm really not overstating this point, but it's totally unfair to go backwards, because again, I just saw somebody who wrote this. Of course, he also called all the products from Shemitah non-kosher from the Het Mechira. But let me continue. So who's stuck in the middle now? Rabbi Hertz, the rabbi of Yaffa. So why is he stuck in the middle? Because the rabbis he asked in Europe said it's okay, but go to the rabbis in Yerushalayim. The rabbis in Yerushalayim said no. So what did he do? He went to the Sephardi rabbis and said, will you give a heter? And then basically told anybody who asked him, the Sephardi rabbi said it's okay, and the Sephardi rabbis again took care of the heter mechira. So, by the way, if you're going to guess now, just, you have no idea, but you're going to guess. So what do you think Rav Avadia Yosef is going to paskin? Is he going to say, well, it's been the long-standing Ashkenazic custom? No. He's going to come out and say, Heta Mechir is 100% fine. Why? And again, a long tshuva about all the history, but he's going to say it's fine because this has been the Sephardic practice long before the Ashkenazim even started arguing about it. This is what the Sephardic poskim had said. Moving over to... So that's already 1888, so let's then go to the next one. 1896. The interesting change now is that the rabbis in the Yerushalayim, who were against it by the previous Shemitah, allowed it in 1896, including Rav Diskin. Why did they allow it? Should I answer the question? Why? Because people are dying. I mean, they realize they need to. There's no choice. So, again, I'm not going to say every rabbi in Yerushalayim, but the major poskim in Yerushalayim allowed it in 1896. 1903, Rav Hertz had... Yes. Rav Hertz again asked the rabbis in Yerushalayim, including Rav Shmuel Salant, the Aderet, Rav Diskin had passed away, and they again allowed it. Rav Hertz himself had passed away, and his son-in-law was the one who did the actual heter this time. But this was again with the bracha of the rabbin in Yerushalayim for the most part. 1910, everything changes. Why? But does everything change by 1910? Because Rav Kook arrived, I believe, around 1904. And now Rav Kook is appointed to take the place of this Rav Hertz. And Rav Kook then establishes the Heta Mechira. And by the way, Rav Kook said it was a bidiyavad. But he, as opposed to everyone else who sort of found a way to do it, he actually sits down and writes a long book, Shabbat Haaretz, saying all the logic and why do it. And he takes everybody on. And I'll say something about Rav Kook, which hopefully will get everybody upset. I personally believe that Rav Kook is overrated in terms of machshava and underrated in terms of halacha. And in terms of his ability as a posek, Rav Kook is sometimes absolutely breathtaking. And he sat down to write. Now, is he writing? And this is part of what we need to understand in terms of this. And as I said, and then we'll be able to get some things that we saw last week. But this background is important. The people who moved to Yerushalayim, the old yeshuv, had the following sensibility. To deserve to live in Israel, we need to keep halacha in the strictest possible way. Which means, and I can show this in numerous examples, the way that halacha was decided by all the major poskim in Europe was different than the way that halacha was decided by the rabbi in Yerushalayim, whose basic feeling was, when in doubt, be machmir. That is not Jewish history. Jewish history is, sometimes you were machmir, sometimes you were mekel, sometimes you were machmir for yourself and mekel for other people. But the rabbi in Yerushalayim was different because we need to deserve to live here. And then B'nai Brak ends up going even further than them, and then you'll have the competition between B'nai Brak and Yerushalayim as far as who can be stricter. And I don't mean to be cynical about this whatsoever. There's an ideology involved. On the other hand, when you're Rav Kook and you're sitting in Yafo, it's no longer the question of deserving to live in Israel. And by the way, Shemitah is a major issue. Why? Because of this week's Parsha, Parshat Bahar and Bichul Kotai. If you don't keep Shemitah, you're going to get kicked out of the land. And that's one of the reasons Chazal. It's said in the Chumash, it's said in the Navi, it's said by Chazal, if you don't keep Shemitah proper, you're kicked out of the land. So the rabbis in Yerushalayim who are non-farmers are saying, you got to keep Shemitah properly. And the farmers are saying, we need to build up this land and we need to establish a viable agricultural community that we will become self-sufficient. So Rav Kook is living in the future, and the rabbis are living, in a sense, in the past. And I'm sorry for putting it that way, but they're living in this idealized, perfect world, which is not a world of working, it's a world living off of donations, and a new world is trying to emerge, a world which will be one which will become self-sufficient. And therefore, they're not going to be speaking the same language at all. So I the first thing I want you to realize is, by Rav Kook giving the Heta Mechira itself, and yes, it's interesting that he gets blamed for it, He's not the first person, the second person, the third person who's done this. It's been done before. But what does he do? He sits down and writes the book, the halacha, why this is okay. His major adversary was a man known as the Ridvaz. The Ridvaz was a rabbi in Tzfat and somebody who had written a commentary on the entire Yerushalmi, saw himself and was an expert in terms of all the laws of agricultural halachot, halachot tliyot ba'aretz, and he attacked Rav Kook in the worst possible ways, even though Rav Kook generally answered him in a very, very nice language. And by the way, on top of all of this, there's a secular press involved, dragging the two sides into fights as well. Also Yerushalayim and all this press, putting misinformation. And there's all kinds of... Everything that you would see happening today, happened then as well. And all kinds of unholy alliances were there also. But as I said, Rav Kook makes a couple of arguments. One argument that he makes is that the argument that was thought to be the Netziv, which was really this Rav Margoliot, that by selling the land, you're breaking a Torah law. Rav Kook disagreed, and he's not the first one. The Kutna Rav had argued as well and said, slow down a second. If I sell the land in order to ensure that there will be a larger Jewish presence in the land, I can't be breaking the halakha by this. Essentially saying, I need to look at this halakha in the macro and not in the micro. I'm going to give you another example, which I think is perfectly parallel. Am I allowed to invite someone to come over Friday night who may drive? What if I don't invite them to sleep over? It depends on what. Right. But am I breaking halacha by inviting them? So I'll tell you, and if you want, we can hopefully maybe put this in as one of the topics, because I think it's very interesting, but I'm going to say something very brief. It's lifnei iver. I'm causing them to sin. But so without explaining anything right now, what if I'm not trying to cause them to sin? What if I truly believe that by inviting them to come over to my house, for those 2 hours they'll sit by my table, my intention is not to put a stumbling block in front of them. My intention is to bring them closer to God. So can I be guilty of lifnei iver if on a macro level I'm trying to help them? Which means, is lifnei iver also a question that either a micro or macro perspective? So as I said, b'li nedra, I'll come back to this. So that's really what they brought up. Rav Kook said, no, it's not that you're breaking the Torah law. And then he tried something else. He said, who said you're not allowed to sell to Muslims? Maybe a Muslim has a halacha of being a ger toshav. You're allowed to sell to a ger toshav. A ger toshav is allowed to stay in the land of Israel. So maybe a ger toshav is somebody who's a monotheist, somebody who accepts the seven mitzvot. So now, in some sources we'll say that the only way you could become a ger toshav is if you stand in front of a beit din, a real beit din, and there has to be during the time of Yovel. So if Kook wanted to argue that all of Muslims who accept as a religion that they believe in one God does not need a beit din to approve them as a ger toshav, as a halacha, it's okay, and you're allowed to sell the land to them. Now, so therefore, by the way, the Chazon Ish argued completely. He goes, who said it makes a difference if you're selling it one little piece or you intend this? Who said that the halacha works in such a way? So the Chazon Ish argued. Rav Kook didn't agree. Rav Kook said, no. I think that this is the halacha. You have to look at the macro, which means the whole purpose of saying lo tem chaniya ba'aretz, that you should not be selling the land, is because you shouldn't be losing the land of Israel. If this is a ploy to hold on to the land of Israel, so therefore it should be allowed. So let me add the following, and I'm skipping lots and lots and lots of things, and I'm going to today. A number of years ago, we had one of our many attempts at creating peace in Israel. I believe maybe it was the Oslo Accords. And after, and when Oslo was signed, Israel was going to give some land to the Palestinian Authority. As far as I understand what happened next, is somebody went and petitioned the court and said, hold it. This is a Shemitah year. The state of Israel doesn't own these lands because it was sold to the Het HaMechira. They can't give them. And the total politics. And the court responded and said, that's not a real thing. It's just a religious thing. And it's not, has no legal standing. By the way, one of the objections of the Ridvaz, and if you remember what we said about Rav Moshe Feinstein about selling the Chametz, remember Rav Moshe Feinstein, it had to be a legal sale? So the Ridvaz says, hold it a second. To sell land in Israel, you need to go, I mean, at that point, I think it was still the Ottoman Empire. You needed to go and have, and get, you had to buy certain stamps in those days. Remember, they still have a certain bullion. And you need to go to this government registry. Selling land is a serious thing. There are tax implications and so on. So the Ridvaz says, excuse me, the whole thing is a joke. It's not a legal sale. So the first one who brought this up was the Ridvaz. But this really happened much, much later. Now, Rav Yashiv had always supported the sale on a b'di'evid way till he heard this. When he heard this, he said, that means it's a joke. If the whole thing's a joke, then forget about it. By the way, the other person who totally supported it, again, b'di'evad, was Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, supported the Het HaMechira. He actually wrote a whole book about the Het HaMechira, which after he passed away, his sons republished without the Het HaMechira in it, and it went from a book this thick to a book this thick. I have both copies at home. I could show you both books. So they reprinted it, and they just reprinted it, totally reinventing who their father was. Which I guess is very nice. When Rav Lau Sr., Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, was chief rabbi, so you may not know, he learned in Kol Torah. He was a student of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He asked him, should we do the Het HaMechira? Rav Shlomo Zalman said, absolutely yes. This is the right thing to do. Which means, again, for the larger country over here, this is the right thing to do. And this could be relied upon. So now let's go back. Before the last Shemitah, I was in a meeting, and one of the people speaking was Ravitzum from Tnuva. The previous Shemitah before that, the Rabbanut refused, first time, the Rabbanut refused to do the Het HaMechira. The Rav Rashi at the time was Rav Metzger, and Rav Metzger said he can't do it, which those who want to say Lashon Hara will say that the whole way he became chief rabbi was because he promised he wouldn't do it, and he was Rav Yashiv's man in there. Today, unfortunately, he's sitting in prison, which of course some of you can, if I want to be very cynical, I could say he was too moral to do the Het HaMechira, but apparently there were other things he was willing to do. And Ravitzum gave the whole background, because he, as the Rav of Tnuva, actually did the Het HaMechira that year. So I asked him, would it have stood up in a court of law, knowing this whole thing about Oslo? So he said, yes. So I said, how do you know? So he said, we went to the government, to the Misrad HaMishpatim, we sat with lawyers, and we built the Het HaMechira in such a way that it would stand up in court. So I said, did Rav Yashiv know this? He said, no. I tried to get in to see him. No one would let me in to see him. Just the people surrounding would not let him in. Which will lead me a little bit, which I'm not going to talk about today, there's the Otzer Beitin, but some of the people who were around the Rav Yashiv were in favor of the Otzer Beitin, and Rav Yashiv had always allowed the Het HaMechira b'di'avad, but when he heard it didn't stand up in court, he wouldn't. But The one 2 years ago stood up in, would have stood up in court, and the one 9 years ago would have stood up in court. Now, one more thing. This past, and then here goes into the realm that you don't know whether to be happy or to cry. Every year when they did the Het HaMechira, from the beginning all the way back, they always sold it to Muslims, because Muslims were considered to be monotheists. This past year, they sold it to somebody who was from Russian Jewish heritage, who, according to the State of Israel, was not Jewish, but was somebody who served in the army, somebody whose family was Jewish, but he technically, I guess his father was Jewish, his mother wasn't Jewish, and his rabbi declared him to be a Ger Toshav, a monotheist, somebody kept Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, served in the army, and this last Hetta Mechira was done with a real Ger Toshav, and somebody who I don't think any of us would have had the same kind of compunction to sell the land to him, because he was somebody who was a law-abiding Israeli citizen who just happened to technically not be Jewish. Of course, the reason I say I don't know to be sad or happy is the reality is we need to find solutions for people like this and find ways of converting people like this who have served in the army. And this is not a small topic, but as I said, I will push that aside. So that pretty much gets me to where I want to start today. How's that for an introduction? So it gets to me where I want to start today. Now, some of the people who spoke about the Hetta Mechira said something which is going to shock you. And that's what we're interested in now. We're interested in total shock value. So if you have the sources from last time, let's see where we will begin. How about the Shulchan Aruch? Is that, one second, we all agree that that's like an authoritative place to look? But, which is interesting because it's the last place people seem to look at in terms of laws of Shemitah. Right? All other people look at pamphlets and this and that. How about the Shulchan Aruch? I mean, I know it's totally radical. So the Shulchan Aruch speaks about Shemitat Ksafim, right? Which goes back to our whole Prizbal discussion. So let's take a look. So I'm just going to warn you about something. If you gave a loan during the Shemitah year, you can't ask for it back unless, what was the one condition? You had a prizbal. So the Rush, 700 years ago, says, I don't know why, but nobody does this anymore. Nobody keeps these laws anymore. These laws have turned into total disuse. So now let's look at the Shulchan Aruch, source 18. Shmidat Ksafim Noheget Minat Torah Ela Bizman Shehayovel Noheg. The only time that we really have Shmidat Ksafim is when there's Yovel. Umidivei Sofer Shmidat Ksafim Noheget Bizman Hazeh. And on a rabbinic level, it should apply. Rama. And skip all of his sources. Avol Yesh Omrim Dehein Shmita Noheget Bizman Hazeh. And some people say there is no Shemitah Bizman Hazeh. One second. Should I read that again? This is the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch. Some say there's no Shemitah at all. V'nira sha'aleim samchu b'dinat elu she'ein no'agin din Shemitah klal Bizman Hazeh. And it must be that those are the opinions that we rely on today. And again, what's the Ramah working off of? And I'll be careful. He's talking about Shemitah Ksafim, which applies all over the world. He says, that must be what people rely on today. Again, so now you realize that the Rush, who lived hundreds of years before the Ramah, is still being quoted by the Ramah. It must be that people just don't keep this at all. The Hamin Hag HaYunogin Adayin Bizman HaRush. But people kept it. It's interesting, because he uses the word a minhag there. Kamo Shekatzuv B'tshuva, Shehayo Tzavach Kruchia Levatel HaMinhag, and so on. Okay, so I guess that should be the second shock for you for today. Regarding which year is actually the Shemitah year, there's an argument. By the way, the Rambam says, this is my opinion, and says, but the Gaonim had a different opinion. And the Ravid says, and the Rambam says we should follow the Gaonim, and the Ravid says we should follow the Rambam. So it's the only place that the Ravid argues the Rambam and says we should follow the Rambam, where the Rambam says we shouldn't follow the Rambam, which is, I know, completely convoluted. He continues and he says, Va'ikar shushnat shin kaf, the shin kaf zayin, and so on, Wer shmita, yihi ratzon shiyirin beit hamikdash v'chzeru, az limnot shmitim biyovalot, ki yavo shilo, and so on, Leferet. And he says, okay, hopefully Mashiach will come and then straighten us all out and then we'll do all these things we're supposed to do. So the second thing is that we don't know when Shemitah is. So let's...
Do you agree with this? I think that we don't know Shemitah. Let's just say they're
He's using this as an added consideration. Source 20, the Sma, one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. Ancient Miksav and Noheged, Uprashad Re'eh, Tiv Miketh Shevashanim, we'll skip to where it's underlined. The Yalfinan from the Gemara in Gittin, Midichtiv, Zedvar Shemitah, Shamut Bakol Bal Masa, Shevashte Shemitah, the cause of Medaber, Bishmita Karkaot, Fahainu Yuval, Shinologbo Elo Hashmatar Karkaot, Shehoyuchozun Alayim. Uvishmia Ksafim did Nishmata Hava Miyamuva. והוק של הדדי לא משה בזמן שאין שמיטת קרקעות זהו היובל נוהג דהיינו בזמן שאין כל יושביה בארץ ישראל וכמו שכתוב ביובל וקראתם דור בארץ לכל יושביה שמיטת כספים גם כן אינו נוהגת. English, that שמיטת כספים is linked to יובל. We saw this last time, right? And it's dependent on all Jews being in Israel. Umidivrei Sofrim, this Ma continues, the Tamakadei Shelo Tishkach Torah Shviat Yisrael. So why is it Midrabanan? That we shouldn't forget these laws completely. Now the next line you're not going to believe. Yes? You ready? Aval Charisha V'Zvira Lo Asru B'Shviat Uviyo Kadei Shelo Tishkach. The only thing that they want the people to remember was the laws of Shemitah Ksafim. Shemitah. Do you see what he just said? Midrabanan, we didn't not allow these things in terms of planting and plowing. Why? Shiloha Yurova Tibu Yachlumma Mobili Surbat Vodar Karka Stationim Shviat Vyovel. Can't cut with a Tosfot. Dafka Bizman Sheshmita Vyovel Noig Minat Torah Haitamikayemet Bema Brachala Gadel Bashanat Shishit Lashalosh Shanim. So he says that on top of all this, if Shemitah is Rabbanan, there's no blessing on the land. And he continues and writes, "Lanita tihay yanir tamacher." Yeah, let's read this. "V'hu dekevin dekedushatan tlui be'aretz v'lo shecha b'chutz la'aretz v'kevin de'lo shecha et lasot ma'od devar b'chutz la'aretz gam be'eretzo lo tiknuhu ma'she'en ken shmitat ksafim shichovat aguf v'kal lahavin." He wants to claim that we don't hold this bizman hazeh. Now, or let me say it differently. The question is how strong it is. Look at the Gra in Source 21, and then after we read it, we're going to go back and explain it. He tells us the same kind of thing linking Shemitah, Ksafim, and Shemitah. Again, I just don't want to read it. Let's go to the top of the next page. Let's do the next, the Grahe. Aval Yesh Omrin. Hu HaRaza. Shekatav Didafka Bizman Shayovel Noheg Midrabanan Shayovel Shmita Kasher Shayin Nifradhu. Vayu Nogin Yovel Adjabat Lu Beitin. The Shmita Tzarch Gamkin Kiddush Beitin. Vahu Bechal Mashakatav Shanim Ata Mekadesh. So he says over here that according to this opinion, that we don't do this at all, is that you need the Beitin to declare Shmita. You can't. It's not just that we're confused, you need a Beitin to declare it. There's no Beitin declaring it, so there's no Shemitah. Continue the Gra in Source 22, Bizman Hazeh, and so on. We say after it, Hinei Latrum Bizman Hazeh Drabbanan, Mash Medachi Elchata. V'chein Rav Yochan Bidrabban, Mekolshken, Dekdushat Yoshua Batla, Shrei Rebbe Hitir Beit Shan. Mekol Makom Kedushat Habayit, Rishalayim, Lo Batla Kedusha Rishona. So he's following the Rambam here by telling us the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim remains, but the mitzvot hatzluot ba'aretz don't remain. I know that I'm going quick and I'm losing you, but it's the next thing that I want you to see. V'chein b'shviat b'zman hazeh. V'katav v'b'zeh mitaretz kedushat tosvot k'ma shekatav puku v'chulei mishum arnona hainu afilu karka Yisrael. Now, you have no idea what I just now read, but what I want you to see is the Gra accepted this, and he said, Tosfot's question is no question, and because of this Gemara. So let's take a look, and we're going to learn this Gemara now, and then this will hopefully make sense. Source 23. The Elu Hein Hapsulin. This is a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. It's the same Mishnah as in Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah are people who are pasul le'idut. one of the people, right, a Masachik Bekuvia, somebody who's a gambler, and one of the people who's Pasul Eidut is called Sochre Shvi'it, somebody who deals in Shvita produce. Amar Rabbi Shimon, B'tchila you korino some Osvei Shvi'it, originally we used to call them people who gather Shmita produce, Misherabu ha'anasin, but when people were forcing them, Chazru l'krot sochre shviyit. Then they said, no, the only people in Arad are the ones who are selling Shmita produce. And Rabbi Yehuda, Eimatai v'zman she'ein lehem umnot elahi, v'yeshem shalohi k'sherin. Let's go to the Gemara, because Gemara wants to know what in the world is going on. Umay ninhu, what are we talking about? What's the pressure? What are the anasim? What is it? So what is it that pressured people to have to work the land? So Rashi writes, Arnona. Anybody here know what the word Arnona means today? This is where it comes from. What's Arnona? Tax. Arnona. Kidemachriz Rabbi Yanai, as Rabbi Yanai declared, Puku uzru bishvi'it mishum ha'arnona. That you, if there are taxes that you have to pay, then you're allowed to work the land and plant during Shvi'it. Chazulomer osvim ksherim sochrim psulim. It's at that point they went back and said that you're allowed to work the land, you just shouldn't be selling it. Now I need to again to explain this. Apparently, it wasn't only in the last 100 years that farmers found themselves in difficult situations and didn't know what to do on Shvi'it. Here we have a source from 2,000 years ago, where pressure came. Let's say the pressure is the government. And the government says you need to pay your taxes. Why don't you have money to pay your taxes? Because you didn't work this year. So what the Gemara say, that's enough of a reason to plant and to work the land on Shvi'it. What does Rashi say? 25. Let's read Rashi at the end. Misherabu anasim chazur lekot el svim sochrim upasa arnona mas shegova hamelech min atvuot kach vakach kurin min asadeh lishana puku zor b'shvid shvid b'zman ezer b'danan di rabanan di bat lakdushat haaretz. So what did Rashi say? That if shmit is midrabanan, what do we generally say about Dinei Drabanan? B'makom tsar lo gazru. Drabanan did not make up their laws in difficult situations. Do you all realize what Rashi just now explained? Rashi said that it's that when the Rabanan made the laws, they said, all things being equal, this is what you should do. So what is this Gemara saying? What did Rabbi Yanai say? Not all things were equal. Why not all things equal? Because we have a reason to work the land. He says, that's enough of a reason. What's remarkable about this Gemara is there's no het mechira. It's allowing the work on Shvi'it, which is Asur Midrabanan, because there's a situation of duress. What does duress mean? Hamatzav kasheh. It's enough of a reason. Some of the rabbis who wanted to allow the het mechira said you don't need a het mechira. The new farmers who moved to Israel are under duress. I have a Gemara which black and white says that in situation of duress, you go and you work the land. So maybe you don't sell the produce, but at least you'll have what to eat. Maybe you barter it, maybe something else. The selling it could still be a problem. But even without the Heter Mechira, you work the land during Shvi'it. There was one Hasidic Rebbe who got all worked up into this. Again, a little bit of background. Somebody who breaks Shabbat, Mechalel Shabbat before Hesia, is considered to be something very bad. So the Chatam Sofer said, what if you publicly break Shabbat, but it's not one of the Lametet Melachot? For example, what if I keep my store open on Shabbat? Can I keep my store open and not break one of the Lametet Melachot? Money is Muktzah. It's not one of the 39 categories of law. So the Chatam Sofer got up and he said, no. If you are publicly desecrating Shabbat, it doesn't have to be one of the Lametet Melachot. Public desecration is public desecration, and you're considered to be Mechalel Shabbat Pefer Hesia. So as I said, there was a Hasidic Rebbe who got up and said that if you follow the Heter Mechira, you're considered to be Mechel Shabbat Pefer Hesya. Because that's also, Shemitah is also Shabbat. So his brother-in-law, whose name was Rav Yosef Engel, responded and wrote a 100-page essay on this topic. And he brought this Gemara on. He said, what are you talking about? You don't need the Heter Mechira. It's a Gemara. By the way, is this also totally surprising? That even without the Heter Mechira, Shemitah b'zman hazeh d'rabanan. You want to get a little fancier? I'm approximating something which is said by the Avni Nezer. I'm not saying it exactly. I'm approximating. Shemitah b'zman hazeh d'rabanan. Do you remember we saw the Ramah saying, but we don't know what year is Shemitah? So that is a safek on a d'rabanan. What is the general principle? Safek d'rabanan. Safek d'raita l'chulmar. Safek d'rabanan l'kula. So if Shemitah is Rabbanan, and we don't know which year is Shemitah, so Safek Rabbanan Lekula, I just now can get rid of Shemitah without even working so hard. But by the way, if I throw in another couple of Sfeikot, I'll be even better. Incidentally, today, in today's year, in today's Shemitah, I have bad news for you. Hardly any Jews do any work in the land anymore. It's all non-Jews that are doing the work in the land anyway. It's not Jews that are working the land. Which is the whole Heter Mechira, one of the questions was, can Jews do the work? Non-Jews do the work. Jews don't work anymore. It's very sad, but even all the kibbutzim are hiring all foreign workers to be doing all kinds of agricultural work, which is another issue involved in this. And now you realize Shemitah is Rabbanan, which I think we pretty much said, by the way, or less. Some say it's not even Rabbanan. We don't even know what year Shemitah is. The Gemara says when there's a situation of duress, you're allowed to do work. So a number of poskim, when they started looking at this, and said, what are you talking about? Yeah, and by the way, it could be, according to what is quoted by the Netziv, really by Rav Moger Liot, that it could be that the fact that you sell it makes things worse, unless you go for this issue of the micro versus the macro consideration in terms of it being a good thing or a bad thing in order to sell. Is it really asur or not asur? But I don't need this. But I'm going to say it again. Shemitah became the most contentious issue, and therefore people calling the food from Shemitah, it's non-kosher and whatever, and so on and so forth, is just not true. When I was in London, I said more than one place, just to get everybody upset with me, I said that I cannot understand how in today's world, when the BDS is boycotting Israeli products, how religious Jews could be part of the boycott. It is a total chilul Hashem. It's a total chilul Hashem to join anti-Semites boycotting Israeli products and religious and every single kashrut organization outside of Israel, from the London Beit to the OU to the Star K, and you can keep on going. Every single one of them have the same attitude. Why should I get involved in such issues? I don't have to rely on the Heter Mechira. Most of them are a little bit stronger than that. But if Israeli produce, if it makes it to markets, by the way, you're not allowed to take things with Kedushat Shviyat, you're not allowed to take them out of Israel. The reason is because people out of Israel won't know how to treat products that have Kedushat Shviyat. But if there's a Heter Mechira, it doesn't have Kedushat Shviyat. I can assure you, Israeli products make it into the markets, and all these kosher organizations drive themselves crazy, and they give public announcement. Israeli peppers were seen in this aisle, and this in this store, right? One cannot buy this, this isn't kosher, and whatever. Excuse me. Shemitah b'zman hazeh d'rabanan. We have a safek what year it is. You have the Heter Mechira, you sold it. It happens to be you sold it to somebody who is a ger toshav. And on top of the whole everything else, the fact that you'd be making anti-Semites happy cannot be a good thing. That's all you need to know in life, by the way. Rabbi Soloveitchik once said this, that non-Jews have radar for Kedusha. If something bothers a non-Jew, you know that that's an important thing in Judaism. Historically, it's totally true. What bothers the non-Jews in Europe? Brit Milah, Shechita, right? Israeli products. So you know that these things are important in Jewish life. So during a time when there is, I'll call it a Shat Hashmad, during a time where there's a public, absolute boycott of Israeli products, to join that boycott is a total Chilul Hashem. So as I said this in a couple of shuls, and I got, I think some people worked up. But it's okay. I said it's totally immoral. The London Beit Din is immoral. By the way, I don't know if I can say it here, but one person agreed with me was Rabbi Kimchi. He actually agreed with what I said, but not publicly. But no, he said, he told me he was troubled by the same thing. So when we now start thinking about this, yes, the Hetter Mechira is the most publicized, contentious fight, where there will be people who will be treating this as like the worst possible thing. In my own shul, I'll admit, this was, I formulated this whole approach that I have, you know, for years and years. Nobody asked me, but a number of you, I mean, I was a rabbi in a shul, which is very different from being the rabbi of a shul. And then Shemitah came, and I told people as follows, that if you would eat in somebody's house the other 6 years, then eat in their house the seventh year, and don't even, it's none of your business what they do. The food is kosher. I don't care if it's the Mechira, the Otzer Beit Din, you know, products from Arabs, and every single solution you have is no good. If you want to read an interesting essay, Rav Lichtenstein wrote this when he moved to Israel, and this is back in the early 70s. He wrote, and he said, there is no good solution to Shemitah. There isn't. The only good solution is that God should give us a bracha, give us triple crops, and we'll have more than enough to put away from beforehand. There's no good solution. Hetter Mechira has its problems, and the Otzer Beit Din has its problems, and buying Arab products has its problems. My son's Rosh Hashiva. I have a son who's been in Otniel for, I don't know, 10, 11 years. He teaches there. But Rav Reima Cohen said that he believes that buying Arab products is abizrayu to ritzicha. It's as if you're guilty of one of the major sins because you're helping people who are not necessarily our friends. Is he overstating this? Perhaps. Perhaps. But realize that when you buy from non-Jewish farmers in Israel, so there's also can be a political issue as well. Does this bother me the most? It doesn't necessarily bother me the most. What bothers me the most is something else. Is you need a solution which will be a good solution for the state of Israel. The state of Israel is a real thing. The Otzer Beit Din, by the way, is not a solution for the state of Israel. It's a solution for a very small part of the population, but it's not going to solve the problem for everybody. So therefore, a major posek is of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who will say, I may not use it, but of course you have to do the Hetter Mechira. Because what's the alternative? By the way, this goes all the way back to from the very beginning. What's the alternative? The alternative is they're getting the farmers who will just keep on farming anyway. So then you'll have then you'll have a real problem. Although, as I said, I can build an argument. The one of the reasons against the Hetter Mechira is that all along the Ashkenazi poskim, and I have to stress this, the Sfaradim never said this. As far as I know, the Ashkenazi poskim always said this is on a one-time basis and needs to be reevaluated the next Shemitah year. So in the past Shemitah, what happened is that, and this is the one before as well, is that even the religious Zionists who would have been followers of Rav Kook have always felt, but Rav Kook said it's b'diavad, we need a better solution, and that has brought them much more towards the Otzer Beit Din. So then the question is the Otzer Beit Din a better solution or a worse solution? So that's something that I'd really like to explore. I'd like to say, and as I said afterwards, I'll stop on the Shemitah and move on to something else, unless you tell me that you're totally bored with this already. But again, I think that there were surprises in this, because when you listen to people talk, oh, somebody sells Shemitah products, that's it, these people can't be trusted and it's not kosher and so on. And you say, hold it a second. Shemitah, I'm sorry I'm repeating myself, but it's for emphasis. Shemitah b'zman hazeh, it's Drabbanan. There are those who claim it's not even Drabbanan. There are those who claim that Shemitah b'zman hazeh doesn't count at all. There is no Shemitah b'zman hazeh. We have a safek of at most a Drabbanan, what year is Shemitah? There are times that this has been a duress, I may not need the Hetter Mechira. I mean, these are all considerations that came into it, but as I said, and this is the part which is not nice, but there was always a fundraising aspect of a part of this. The old yeshuv subsisted on donations. And if people become independent, then maybe we need net less donations. The Shemitah year has been and continues to be an opportunity for people to raise more money. And every single Shemitah year you can look back and say, oh, look, I can raise more money now because you have to support all those brave farmers who are not working. And I'm not being cynical about that. But I just do want to point out that there's always been this other element of Shemitah, which may or may not. From right at the time of the Ridvaz, he was attacked for attacking Rav Kook. So he was attacked by saying, there are financial interests in this. So again, I want to be careful, but going along, yes, there's always been financial issues in this. So we're going to stop here. I do want to get to the Otzah Beit Din. The first thing which is interesting about the Otzah Beit Din is who in the world made it up? Who made it up? Who made up the Otzah Beit Din? That's going to be our first question, who made it up? So support Rav Rimon, if you look at his book on Shemitah, he says Rav Kook made it up. So I don't believe that that's true. So that's going to be our first thing, who made it up? Follows the Chazon Ish, think the Chazon Ish made it up, but it was here before the Chazon Ish. I know who made it up, which is itself a little bit of detective work. So I will share with you that detective work. But the Otzah Beit Din then is the next thing. And is it really better than the... Is it really preferable? So that we'll see. B'li Neder next time.